Good afternoon. This is a reading of the Arizona Daily Star for Monday, the 13th of October. Mark DeGroft with you here on Sun Sounds. From Phoenix, the crackdown on illegal immigration could result in fewer farm workers and boost food prices even higher, the U.S. Department of Labor is formally acknowledging. In a new filing in the Federal Register, the agency acknowledges that labor costs already are a major component of the cost of agriculture, especially in the specialty crop sectors where relatively large numbers of illegal aliens are employed. Given the scale, speed, and investment in the federal government's efforts to enforce immigration laws and restore the integrity of the U.S. border, the department concludes that there will be significant labor market effects in the agricultural sector, which has been long pushed to depend on a workforce with high proportion of illegal aliens, the filing states. Legal residents who are unemployed or working only part-time now are going likely to suddenly decide to take jobs that are no longer filled by immigrant labor, the agency says. Without swift action, agricultural employers will be unable to maintain operations, and the nation's food supply will also be at risk, according to the notice. The filing is not being done in a vacuum. Instead, it is part of a move by the Department of Labor to make it easier for farmers to hire migrant workers who can come into the country through the H-2A visa program. That program allows foreign nationals to enter the country to perform seasonal labor when there is a shortage of domestic workers. The rules would allow farmers to pay those they employ through this program less than they do now. That is designed to deal with the fact that farmers hire and depend on illegal immigrant workers. A substantial body of research estimates that illegal alien workers earn between 4% and 24% less than similarly situated legal workers, giving employers a strong financial incentive to hire illegal labor, the Labor Department filing says. So the solution, the agency says, is to close the gap between what farmers have to pay under the H-2A program and what they are already paying for those here legally. Without prompt action, agriculture employees will face severe labor shortages, resulting in disruption to food production, higher prices, and reduced access to U.S. customers, particularly to fruits and vegetables, according to the filing. The agency also concludes that there's no particular reason to maintain wages farmers are required to pay migrant labor when they are in hopes of finding more legal U.S. workers to take some of the jobs at those rates, often barely above minimum wage. The department concludes that qualified and eligible U.S. workers will not make themselves available in sufficient numbers, even at current wage levels, to fill the significant labor shortage in the agriculture sector, it states. So that leaves the alternative the Labor Department is enacting. Let farmers pay legal migrant workers even less than they do now. The American Farm Bureau Federation figures that for those with minimal skills, people who would not require training, that new minimum in Arizona would be $15.32 an hour, and that is 10% less than now. The Pima County Board of Supervisors will consider a resolution tomorrow standing up to any effort by the Trump administration to politicize higher education and suppress the viewpoints of the diverse communities that are served by the University of Arizona. The resolution was placed on the agenda for the board's October 14th meeting by Supervisor Jennifer Allen. The statement notes that the county board, if it approves the resolution, would join the chorus of voices already on record as opposing the White House's request that 9 universities, including the University of Arizona, commit to Trump's higher education agenda in order to keep federal benefits and receive funding advantages. Southern Arizona's elected and community leaders are calling on U of A President Suresh Garamella to hold the line, citing major concerns about federal overreach and the erosion of academic freedom. Allen's proposed resolution states, adding that a similar resolution approved on Wednesday by the Tucson City Council serves as a template. It notes that the faculty senate has also asked Aramella to reject Trump's administration's compact for academic excellence in higher education. In addition, about 80 U of A Regents professors, a title designating distinction, sent a letter to Aramella asking him to oppose the compact and warning that there is no assurance that the university will get federal funding benefits for complying. The White House set a November 21st deadline for the 9 universities to sign the compact, sent to them on October 1st. In addition to the University of Arizona, there are Vanderbilt, the University of Pennsylvania, Dartmouth College, the University of Southern California, Brown University, and the University of Virginia. The compact would require the U of A to ban the use of race of sex in hiring and admissions, freeze tuition for 5 years, cap international undergrad enrollment at 15%, apply a strict definition of gender to campus bathrooms, locker rooms, and women's sports teams, transform or abolish departments that belittle conservative ideas, bar employees from speaking out as university representatives on external societal and political events, and other requirements. It also calls for a diverse mix of political voices on campus and for cutbacks to university administrative costs, among many other requests. Aramella has said he's working with the Board of Regents to understand its full scope and implications and gathering input from leaders representing faculty, staff, and students, among others. The board meeting begins at 9 o'clock a.m. at the Pima County Administration Building, and that's located at 130 West Congress Street in the first floor Board of Supervisors hearing room. Tourist business battered by a wildfire that wrecked the Grand Canyon North Rim summer season are hoping that something long wished but formerly improbable could emerge from the ashes, a year-round tourism attraction on the national park's quiet side. The National Park Service closed down the North Rim in winter, in part because of the historic Grand Canyon Lodge was built for summer with shallow pipes that would freeze in the winter. But the lodge burned in July, opening the possibility that the agency could build a replacement lodge capable of handling winter visitors. The often snowy State Route 67, stretching some 43 miles south from Jacob Lake Inn to the lodge and scenic overlooks, goes unplowed after the first big storm. The closure shrouds the 8,000-foot-high plateau and its elk, bison, and occasional backcountry skiers in a winter wilderness that some advocates hope to protect and others seek to unlock. Some environmentalists and at least one former governor who has skied the terrain want to keep it as it is, quiet in winter. Others find the business prospects tantalizing. That would be huge, Cliff Dwellers Lodge co-owner Wendy Gunn said. For entrepreneurs arrayed along a striking 2-hour drive past red cliff bands, circling condors and high pine stands from Marble Canyon to the Kaibab Plateau to Kanab, Utah, the downtime from November to May deals them out of the otherwise lucrative Grand Circle route from park to park in southern Arizona, or northern Arizona and southern Utah. We have pushed for an opening of the North Rim year-round for many years, said Sean Riding, a Kanab restaurant who co-owns Kayak the Colorado, a kayak rental and river shuttle company that operates in Lee's Ferry section above the Grand Canyon. Tourism to Kanab and points north of the state line has grown in all seasons since a spike in outdoor activity during the COVID pandemic, he said, and more of those people would pass through northern Arizona as well if they had a premier wintertime destination. For instance, a glimpse into one of the natural wonders of the world from a snow-covered cliff. If the government rebuilds Grand Canyon Lodge, he hopes it will be a winterized tourist magnet. Gosh, he said, if they could open the North Rim in winter, I'd just see it to be a huge benefit to everybody in the area. The Park Service has hinted that it may grant his wish, updating colleagues on the Dragon Bravo fire during a meeting of the Glen Canyon Adoptive Management Program back in August. Grand Canyon Superintendent Ed Keeble said rebuilding the lodge creates an opportunity to keep it open all year. We had been planning on extending the season even before the fire, Keeble said, using funds from the Great American Outdoors Act to winterize the lodge and enable a season lasting at least through December. The limitations of working with a remote lodge dating to the Great Depression made full winter operations unlikely, he said, but those limitations vanish with a new lodge built from the ground up. Business owners who have participated in post-fire meetings with the Park Service and Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs say those officials have repeatedly discussed the possibility of a winter season when the lodge reopens. The agency has not started a public process to study the issue or gather comments, though, and Keeble noted that there are different opinions on that. The number of international student arrivals in the United States dropped by nearly a fifth in August as American universities started the new academic year, this according to federal data. The dip is the latest sign of a hit to colleges' international enrollment as the Trump administration ratchets up scrutiny of foreign students. International visitors arriving to the U.S. on student visas declined 19% in August, compared with the same month in 2024, this according to the preliminary data released by the National Travel and Tourism Office. The numbers declined also in June and July, but August is the summer month that typically sees the most international student arrivals, 313,138 this year. As the federal government has clamped down on student visas, industry groups have warned of international enrollment declines that threaten school budgets and Americans' college standing in the world. While the full extent of the change remains to be seen, the new data suggests a turnaround in international enrollment that had been rebounding in the United States from a decline worsened by the COVID-19 pandemic. Around 1.1 million international students were in the U.S. last year, a source of key revenue for tuition-driven colleges. International students aren't eligible for federal financial aid, and many pay full tuition. Many students who had plans to study in the U.S. could not enter the country because of difficulty lining up visas. In late May, the State Department paused the scheduling of visa interviews for foreign students, which resumed 3 weeks later with new rules for vetting visa applicants' social media accounts. The timing of the pause had maximum possible impact for visa issuances for the fall semester, said Clay Harmon, who is the executive director of the Association of International Enrollment Management, a nonprofit membership organization. A travel ban and other restrictions for 19 countries the Trump administration announced in June created even more uncertainty for some of those students. Turning to Tucson regional news at 13 minutes after the hour, a consumer fraud lawsuit has been filed against the owners and operators of a mobile home park on Tucson's south side over its extremely dangerous, unreliable, and overloaded electrical system. Residents of Palo Verde Mobile Home Park near East Alvord Road and South Alvernon Way have had to deal with regular power outages, creating dangerous conditions due to a lack of access to air conditioning, Arizona Attorney General Chris May said in a news release. Arizonans are being placed in repeated, extremely dangerous circumstances while their electricity is out and their landlord fails to fix it. It may feel like there's no one to call for help, but my office can and will intervene to protect consumers when landlords fail to live up to their end of the bargain, May said in a written statement. Air conditioning and electrical outages in Arizona aren't just dangerous, they're deadly. The lawsuit follows a demand letter May's office sent to the park owners. The lawsuit says the owner of Palo Verde Mobile Home Park, Landon Asset Management, which owns 18 homes in the park, and Landon Management Services, PC, the park's property management company, violated the state's Consumer Fraud Act. It says the park failed to inform residents that its electrical system was outdated and insufficient to power basic appliances and air conditioning systems. As a result, Palo Verde Mobile Home Park residents have been left exposed to risk of electrical fires and regularly lose power to air conditioning their homes for hours at a time during extreme heat spikes, the release said. In Pima County, for example, mobile home residents make up 10% of all housing, but account for 30% of heat-related deaths, the release said. It said frequent power outages make mobile homes especially difficult to cool. Representative Andy Biggs's recent claim about high-income people paying no money for health insurance premiums via the Affordable Care Act exchange is either very rare or not true. Biggs, an Arizona Republican who is running for governor, said in a Good Morning Arizona appearance on October 9th that there are people earning $600,000 per year who are getting free health premiums via the Affordable Care Act, or ACA, exchange because of the enhanced premium tax credits at the center of the federal government shutdown. So you have people who are not paying any premiums at all, who might be making $600,000, who don't have to pay any premium at all for their health care if they're on the exchange, Biggs said during his appearance on Arizona Family on KTVK television. The Washington Times, in a September 26 article, quoted House Speaker Mike Johnson, a Republican from Louisiana, citing a similar fact that people who make $600,000 per year get a government subsidy for their health care. Brian Blaze, who worked for Trump during his first term and is now president of the Paragon Health Institute, a conservative think tank, repeated a similar claim on Biggs's What's the Biggs Idea, an October 9th podcast. The enhanced premium tax credits, which are set to expire at the end of the year, are the focus of the dispute between the Republicans and Democrats that has shut down the federal government. Congress's Joint Commission on Taxation on September 18th found that most of the enhanced premium tax credit dollars are going to people with incomes below $150,000, which amounts to more than four times the federal poverty level for a family of four. It is true that some people with ACA plans do not pay any monthly premiums because of the state tax subsidies via enhanced premium tax credits that they receive. It's also true that the enhanced subsidies that took effect under President Joe Biden, which some refer to as the Biden COVID credits, made people earning higher incomes, higher than 400% of the federal poverty level, eligible for federal subsidies to help pay for their health insurance. In addition, the enhanced credits means that no one would need to pay more than 8.5% of their income for the second lowest cost silver plan. ACA plans are grouped into metal tiers, bronze, silver, and gold. Gold is the highest level plan, and silver is the most popular. But Biggs's claim that someone earning $600,000 a year would be getting a federal subsidy that allows free monthly ACA premiums is not a real thing, said Will Humble, the executive director of the Arizona Public Health Association. I don't see how that is possible, he said. He's either misinformed or he made it up. No one is getting free premiums at that level. There are probably people who make that much who didn't pay anything for health care because their job is giving it to them. Democrats want to extend the enhanced credits, saying they make health insurance more affordable and prevent Americans from being uninsured. But Republicans like Biggs point out that the enhanced credits took effect in 2021 during the COVID-19 pandemic and were never meant to be a long-term benefit of having ACA coverage. ACA plans are sometimes known as Obamacare, and about 423,000 Arizonans bought 2025 plans via the healthcare.gov insurance exchange, federal data shows. From Phoenix, the Sheriff's Office for Metro Phoenix spent millions of dollars budgeted for compliance costs in a racial profiling case over Joe Arpaio's immigration crackdowns on things that had little or nothing to do with the court-ordered overhaul of the agency. This according to an expert's report. The report that was released on Wednesday criticized the use of compliance money by the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office to fund personnel costs and tasks, either in part or in full, that aren't connected to the overhaul. It also pointed out inappropriate spending, $2.8 million for surplus body-worn camera licenses that went beyond the court's orders, $1.5 million in renovations in the relocation of an internal affairs office, over $1.3 million to buy 42 vehicles, and an $11,000 golf cart to bring staff from headquarters to the internal affairs operation, even though the department was leasing parking space at the latter location. For over a decade, Maricopa County taxpayers have picked up the bill for remedying constitutional violations found in a 2013 profiling verdict over then-Sheriff Arpaio's traffic patrols targeting immigrants. The racial profiling case centered on 20 large-scale traffic patrols that was launched by Arpaio and targeted immigrants from January of 2008 through October of 2011. That led to the profiling verdict and expensive court-ordered overhauls of the agency's traffic patrol operations and later its internal affairs unit. The county says $323 million has been spent so far on legal expenditures. Staff that monitors the Sheriff's Department's progress and the agency's compliance costs. The county has said that the total is expected to reach $352 million by July of next year. The federal judge presiding over the case expressed concerns about transparency in spending the sheriff's office and ordered a review leading to a blistering report from budget analysts. The report was prepared by budget analysts picked by the case's monitor. The report concluded 72% of the $226 million in spending by the Sheriff's Office from February of 2014 to late September of 2024 was either wrongly attributed or improperly prorated to a compliance fund. Budget analysts who reviewed hundreds of employee records over roughly that time period found an average of 70% of all positions funded by compliance money were inappropriately assigned or only partially related to compliance. Those expenditures were unrelated and/or unnecessary for compliance, lacked appropriate justification, or resulted from purposeful misrepresentation by the sheriff's office, county leaders, or both, the budget analyst wrote. And beginning earlier this year, county officials ramped up their criticism of the spending. They said the agency should not still be under the court's supervision a dozen years after the verdict or still be paying such hefty bills, including about $30 million, to those who monitor the agency on behalf of the judge since around 2014. In a statement, Sheriff Jeffrey Sheridan said that there were discrepancies in the report and pointed out that the examination by the budget analysts excluded money paid to the monitor team and for legal expenses. Sheridan, who took office this year, is the fourth sheriff to grapple with the case. Raul Pena, a longtime member of a community advisory board that was created to help improve trust in the sheriff's office, said the report opens up a broader conversation about the integrity of the sheriff's office. "You will have to double-check now whenever the agency talks about statistics," Pena said. Beginning earlier this year, county officials ramped up their criticism of the spending. They said the agency still shouldn't be under the court supervision a dozen years after the verdict and shouldn't still be paying such hefty bills, including about $30 million to those who monitor the agency on behalf of the judge since around 2014. Oscar-winning actress Diane Keaton had a thing for Tucson, Arizona, as the USA Today described her in a 2018 article. "I just love Tucson," said Keaton, who died on Saturday in California at the age of 79, as spoken to Jimmy Kimmel on his show in May of 2018. "I bought a barrio property there, and I'm really excited," she shared with Kimmel. "I'm going to redo that and fix the adobe." Tucson is underappreciated, she said. If that was so, it no longer was, perhaps, at least in real estate terms. When Keaton was through flipping through the historic home in Barrio Viejo, which dated to at least the 1880s, she sold it for $2.2 million in 2021 after buying it for $1.5 million 3 years earlier. She did end up getting less than her $2.6 million asking price, though. Even $1.5 million was an eye-popping number for the historic neighborhood at the time, the Arizona Daily Star reported when Keaton paid cash, $328 per square foot, for the Adobe Now home in 2018. Keaton was gracious and striking, wearing her glasses and 4-inch heels when she first came to visit the property, its previous owner told the Star at the time. The actress was an interior designer in her own right, known for her quintessential design aesthetic, said realtors representing the buyer when Keaton sold the home in 2021, after she renovated the interior and added a pool and upgraded landscaping. Or, as Realtor.com put it in a headline, Diane Keaton gives a glow up to a desert delight in Tucson. Keaton's love for fixing up and selling historic homes was well chronicled, and she had been scoping out Tucson for years. Keaton and her sister, Dori Hall, also have been listed in property records as owners of a home in historic Tubac, south of Tucson. Not all of Keaton's renovations here got rave reviews, however. She was cited by the city of Tucson in October of 2020, the Star reported, for adding new decorative light fixtures and 17 roof water spouts known as canales to the front of the Barry House without prior approval. Those violations were resolved when the Barrio Histórico Historic Zone Advisory Board told her she could keep the lights, but forced her to remove at least 7 of the fake canales and make the remaining ones functional. Turning to business news at 25 after the hour, Target is rolling out new self-checkout kiosks designed for blind and low-vision shoppers, and the retailer isn't keeping the technology to itself. The Minneapolis-based company says the first of its kind stations are in 200 stores and will expand to all locations by early next year. Target has chosen not to patent the tactile controller it co-developed with ELO, which manufactures touchscreens for retailers and other companies. The retailer had the 5th most patents of Minnesota-based companies in 2024. Target worked with the National Federation of the Blind, the NFB, during the machine's development, design, and testing. Their feedback, along with other blind community members, directly shaped the technology, according to a news release. The features, such as high-contrast button icons, a headphone jack with adjustable volume control, and physical navigation buttons, are common among devices designed for people who are blind or have low vision, but the touchscreen has streamlined use of the functions to better meet the needs of blind and low vision customers. The technology will be added to existing kiosks, and all self-checkout stations will be accessible, a Target spokeswoman confirmed. Advocates say the move could be a turning point for shoppers who have been excluded from the self-checkout experience, especially now that it's available as non-patented technology. As a blind person myself, I've seen for years that we've been reducing the number of human cashiers in favor of self-checkout experiences, and not a single one of those until now has been usable by me, said Corb O'Connor, who is president of the NFB of Minnesota. O'Connor said he often had to wait 10 to 15 minutes in full-service lanes, even with just a few items, while shoppers with access to self-checkout could move more quickly. Self-checkout has lagged behind other accessibility initiatives, O'Connor said, partly because there aren't many legal guidelines around applying digital accessibility to physical experiences in the store. I look at this as a real opportunity for other retailers, since the device isn't patented, O'Connor said. Retailers no longer can say, well, we don't know how to do it, or our vendor doesn't know how to do it. The technology is now there. In 2018, the NFB sued Walmart under the Americans with Disabilities Act, arguing that its kiosks excluded blind people from using the service in the way it was intended, independently and privately. A federal judge in Maryland sided with Walmart in 2021, writing that the retailer's existing tactile keypad and staff training direct blind customers to that keypad was sufficient in protecting the shopper's private financial information and meeting accessibility requirements. O'Connor called the ruling a misunderstanding by the judge of what accessibility means. Accessibility is not about being able to complete a task, O'Connor said. Accessibility is about saying, I can use the same technology that's available to everybody else, independently, and in the same amount of time. Walmart did not return a request for comment about the current accessibility of its self-checkout machines. The kiosks are already in 5 Minnesota Target stores, including Brooklyn Park, Maple Grove, and Burnsville, a spokeswoman said. While designed primarily for blind or low-vision customers, Target said the features have additional benefits for shoppers with motor disabilities. Steve Decker, a blind user experience accessibility manager at Target, who helped develop the technology, said he was able to use the kiosk with his daughter, who also has low vision. It's not just tech, he said in the release. It's joy, independence, and change. Mark Riccobono, who's president of the Baltimore-based NFB, said in the release Target stood out for working directly with the blind community during the design process, also calling the retailer an industry leader and a true partner in accessibility. Target has a history of working with the NFB, the oldest and largest organization in the country led by blind people. In 2006, the NFB sued the retailer over its website, which was inaccessible at the time. Blind users said they could shop online at Best Buy, Walmart, and other retailers, but not at Target, according to Star Tribune reporting. That case led to the first legal precedent requiring commercial websites to be accessible under the Americans with Disabilities Act and state laws. Since then, Target has worked with the NFB to add adaptive clothing lines, home products, and other offerings developed with input from people with disabilities. I know I sometimes pay a little more to shop at Target, O'Connor said, but for me, having an app that is super accessible, that was built with people with disabilities in mind, built by people with disabilities, that's worth the extra few bucks that I can sometimes spend on laundry detergent because I know I can actually shop through all of those available options. The economic boom promised by Trump centers on a single number, $17 trillion. That's a sum of new investments Trump claims to have generated with his tariffs, income tax cuts, and aggressive salesmanship of CEOs, financiers, tech titans, prime ministers, presidents, and other rulers. The $17 trillion is supposed to fund new factories, new technologies, more jobs, higher incomes, and faster economic growth. Under 8 months of Trump, we've already secured commitments of $17 trillion coming in, the president said in a speech last month. There's never been any country that's done anything like that. But based on statements from various companies, foreign countries, and the White House's own website, that figures to be exaggerated, highly speculative, and far higher than the actual sum. The White House website lists total investments as $8.8 trillion, though that figure appears to be padded with some investment commitments that are made during Joe Biden's presidency. The White House didn't lay out the math after multiple requests on how Trump calculated $17 trillion in investment commitments. But the issue goes beyond Trump's hyperbolic talk to his belief that the brute force of tariffs and shaming of companies for him politically if the tough talk fails to translate into more jobs and higher companies. Incomes, that is. Adam Posen, president of the Peterson Institute of International Economics, said the public commitments announced by Trump represent a meaningful increase, but one that amounts to hundreds of billions of dollars, not trillions. Even then, that comes with long-term costs, as countries might be less inclined to invest within the United States after being threatened to do so. It's a national security mistake because you're turning allies into colonies of a sort. You're forcibly extracting from them things that they don't see as entirely in their interest, Posen said. Twisting the arms of governments to then twist the arms of their own businesses is not going to get you the payoff that you want. Trump administration is betting that tariffs are an effective tool to prod other countries and international companies to invest in the United States, a big stick that other administrations fail to wield. Trump's pitch to voters is that he will play a role in directly managing the investment commitments made by foreign countries, and that the allocation of that money starting next year will revive what has been a flagging job market. The difference between hypothetical investments and ground being broken on new factories and facilities is good leadership and sound policy, the White House said, White House spokesman Kush Desai. The White House said that Japan will invest $1 trillion, largely at Trump's direction. The European Union will commit $600 billion. The United Arab Emirates made commitments of $1.4 trillion over 10 years. Qatar pledged $1.2 trillion. Saudi Arabia intends to pony up $600 billion. India, $500 billion. And South Korea, $450 billion, among others. The challenge is the precise terms of those investments have yet to be fully codified and released to the public, and some numbers are under dispute, potentially fuzzy math, or in the case of Qatar, more than five times the annual gross domestic product of the entire country. The White House maintains that Qatar is good for the money because it produces oil. From what I've seen, these commitments are worth about just as much as the paper they're written down on, said Jaron Bernstein, who was the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers in the Biden White House. As for the $600 billion committed by European companies, that's based on those businesses having expressed interest and having stated intentions to do so. Through 2029 rather than an overt concession, according to European Union documents. And so far, there's yet to be a notable increase in business investment as a percentage of U.S. gross domestic product. As a share of the overall economy, business investment during the first 6 months of Trump's presidency has been consistently bouncing around 14%, just as it was before the pandemic. And turning to the letters to the editor at just about 20 minutes till, the current weather forecasts predict substantial rain from Hurricane Priscilla, prompting many of us to recall the devastating Great Flood of 1983 caused by a hurricane from Mexico. I was project manager for the original Rio Nuevo Santa Cruz widening soil cement riverbank protection and linear park project just completed in 1982. We were actually over-designed the channel section to handle 45,000 CFS, that's 1.5 times the official 100-year event Q100, or 30,000 CFS, and provided 5 feet of freeboard. The Santa Cruz ran bank to bank, water lapping at the bottom of the Congress, St. Mary's, and Speedway bridge girders. An estimated 60,000 CFS passed safely through, approaching a 500-year storm flow. Had we not over-designed and completed the project when we did, the commercial development from 22nd Street to nearly Grant Road would have been wiped out. Looking back on that incredible event, I am amazed at the perfect, perhaps providential timing that prevented what would have been a catastrophic disaster. And that was written by John A. Evans, who is a professional engineer and lives in Vail. Ford Burkhardt, who lives in Midtown, writes, "With all the noise these days, we need a steady hand or two. That would be City Council member Kevin Dahl, in my humble opinion. No matter the topic, he hears all sides and really listens. He polished these skills for decades working for the environment for key organizations. He knows the issues and, most important, the people he serves as council member. Nobody works harder and with more people skills." And Claudette Haney from Green Valley writes, "It seems that a great number of our citizens are very concerned about the course of our American political and social life. Protests are regular occurrences. We are urged to resist. We are urged to boycott. My question is this: would it not be helpful to simply divest? If corporations are paying for and leading the federal decision makers to act in ways we feel are harmful, would it not make sense to withdraw our investments in them? If I actually knew the answer to that, I wouldn't ask. Thank you. Again, Claudette Haney from Green Valley. And Melanie Bell, who lives in Midtown, writes that thank you to the Star for printing multiple articles on the importance of refusing Trump's bullying offer to give the U of A special favors if we give up academic freedom and self-governance. It's just the latest in a series of attacks on higher education. As a recent Chronicle of Higher Education article stated, the genius of American higher education lies in its diversity. This impact would flatten the diversity into a federally dictated model, replacing interdependence with political conformity. President Garamella, have the courage to protect our university and say no. And Ira Adler from the Foothills writes, Dear Chuck Cecil, we agree that more fans in the seats of Arizona Stadium would lift the players. Perhaps some of that NIL money could be used to help us afford those seats. At $340 plus parking and concessions, a couple would have to come up with almost $1,000 for each game. Does the university really want a full stadium? Then lower the price to make it affordable. It's really just simple economics. Oh, and televise the games on non-pay TV stations like ESPN. Again, that was Ira Adler, and he lives in the Foothills. Turning now to national world news, Vice President J.D. Vance on Sunday, yesterday, said there will be deeper cuts to the federal workforce the longer the government shutdown goes on, adding to the uncertainty facing hundreds of thousands who are already furloughed without pay amid the stubborn stalemate in Congress. Vance warned that as federal shutdown entered its 12th day, the new cuts would be painful, even as he said the Trump administration worked to ensure that the military is paid this week and some services would be preserved for low-income Americans, including food assistance. Still, hundreds of thousands of government workers were furloughed in recent days, and in a court filing on Friday, the Office of Management and Budget said that well over 4,000 federal employees would soon be fired in conjunction with the shutdown. The longer this goes on, the deeper the cuts are going to be, Vance said on Fox News Sunday Morning Futures. To be clear, some of these cuts are going to be painful. This is not a situation that we relish. This is not something that we're looking forward to. But the Democrats have dealt us a pretty difficult set of cards. Labor unions have already filed a lawsuit to stop the aggressive move by Trump's budget office, which goes far beyond what usually happens in a government shutdown, inflaming tensions between Republicans who control Congress and the Democratic minority. The shutdown began on October 1st after Democrats rejected a short-term funding fix and demanded that the bill include an extension of federal subsidies for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. The expiration of those subsidies at the end of the year will result in cost increases for millions. Trump and Republican leaders have said they're open to negotiations on the health subsidies, but insist the government must reopen first. For now, negotiations are virtually non-existent. House leaders from both parties pointed fingers at each other in rival Sunday appearances on Fox News Sunday. We have repeatedly made clear that we will sit down with anybody, anytime, any place, said House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York. Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the presidency. It's unfortunate they're taking a my way or the highway approach. House Speaker Mike Johnson blamed Democrats, said they don't seem to care about the pain the shutdown is inflicting. They're trying their best to distract the American people from the simple fact that they've chosen a partisan fight so that they can prove to their Marxist rising base in the Democratic Party that they're willing to fight Trump and Republicans, he said. Progressive activists, meanwhile, expressed new support for the Democratic Party's opposition in the shutdown fight. Ezra Levin, who is the co-founder of the leading progressive protest group Indivisible, said he is feeling good about the strength of the Democratic position. Looking at the short stuff in the digest, from aboard Air Force One, Trump warned Russia on Sunday that he may send Ukraine long-range Tomahawk missiles if Moscow doesn't settle its war there soon, suggesting that he could be ready to increase the pressure on Vladimir Putin's government using a key weapon system. I might say, look, if this war isn't going to get settled, I'm going to send them Tomahawks, Trump told reporters above Air Force One as he flew to Israel. The Tomahawk is an incredible weapon, very offensive weapon, and honestly, Russia does not need that. Trump said, I might tell them that if the war is not settled, that he may very well, he added, we may not, but we may do it. I think it's appropriate to bring up. From St. Helena Island, South Carolina, a mass shooting early yesterday at a crowded bar on an idyllic island considered to be the largest gulag community on the South Carolina coast left 4 people dead and at least 20 people injured, officials said. A large crowd was at Willie's Bar and Grill on St. Helena Island when sheriff's deputies arrived and found that many people had gunshot wounds. An estimated 5,000 or more Gullah people living on the island traced their ancestry back to enslaved West Africans who once worked rice plantations in the area before being freed by the Civil War. The Beaufort County Sheriff's Office said in a statement on the social platform X, we ask for your patience as we continue to investigate this incident. The president of Madagascar said yesterday an attempted coup was underway in the Indian Ocean country just a day after members of an elite army unit joined youth-led protests against the government and called for the president to step down. President Andry Rajoelina's office offered no details on who was behind that attempt. Estonia temporarily closed access for its citizens to a road they normally use that passes through a stretch of Russian territory after the Interior Ministry reported a group of Russian soldiers standing there, Estonian's public broadcaster said yesterday. Afghanistan also said yesterday it killed 58 Pakistani soldiers in overnight border operations in response to what it called repeated violations of its territory and airspace. Pakistan's army gave far lower casualty figures, saying 23 troops were killed. From the China Sea, a Chinese Coast Guard ship used a powerful water cannon yesterday, then rammed and slightly damaged an anchored Philippine government vessel off of an island inhabited by Filipinos in the disputed South China Sea, the Philippine Coast Guard said. No injuries were reported. British police arrested 2 men on suspicion of murder after the former Lost Prophets singer Ian Watkins was stabbed to death Saturday in a prison in northern England, where he was serving a 29-year sentence for child sex offenses. And Kosovo held municipal elections yesterday with the government left-wing self-determination movement, or Vendosje, seeking to capture City Hall in the capital of Pristina amid lingering political tensions and strained relations with Serbia. From Beijing, China signaled yesterday that it would not back down in the face of a 100% tariff threat from Trump and urged the United States to resolve differences through negotiations instead of threats. Trump responded by taking a less confrontational approach without retreating from his demands, while his vice president seemed to warn Beijing not to react aggressively. China's stance is consistent, the Commerce Ministry said in a statement posted online. We don't want a tariff war, but we're not afraid of one. It was China's first official comment on Trump's threat to jack up the tax on imports from China by November 1st in response to new Chinese restrictions on the export of rare earths, which are vital to a wide range of consumer and military products. Hours later, Trump used his Truth Social platform to send a message to Chinese leader Xi Jinping. Don't worry about China. It'll all be fine, the Republican president wrote. highly respected President Xi just had a bad moment. He doesn't want depression for his country, and neither do I. The USA wants to help China, not hurt it. Trump may have an eye toward U.S. financial markets on the eve of the new business week. The stock market will open on Monday, today, though bond markets will close for the Columbus Day holiday. On Friday, the broad S&P 500 stock market index plunged 2.7%, its worst day in about 6 months under Trump's tariff threat. A nor'easter turned its way up the East Coast yesterday, washing out roads and prompting air travel delays as heavily populated areas of the Northeast experienced excessive rain, lashing winds, and coastal flooding. Across the continent in western Alaska, the remnants of Typhoon Heilong brought hurricane-force winds and catastrophic flooding to coastal communities where entire houses were pushed off their foundations. Rescue boats and aircraft were dispatched to the tiny Alaskan villages Ke'ik'nu'inpuk and Quilingok, where there were reports of up to 20 people possibly unaccounted for, said Jeremy Zydek, a spokesperson for the State Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. We have received reports that people's homes have floated away and that people were potentially in those homes, Zydek told the Associated Press. More than 170 people stayed overnight at a community shelter in Ke'ik'nu'k. The water level rose overnight 6.6 feet above the highest tide. At least Ames were washed away, Zydek said. Roads and boardwalks were inundated. Power lines were damaged in Bethel, Napastiak, Napakakiak, and other Yukon Kuskokwim communities. Every effort will be made to help those that were hit by this storm. Help is on the way, Governor Mike Dunleavy said in a statement. The area is among one of the most isolated in the United States, where some communities have a few roads and residents use boardwalks, boats, and snowmobiles to get around. Floodwaters could rise from the Carolinas north to New Jersey, forecasters have warned. The greatest effects are going to have the coastal flooding potential, said meteorologist Bob Orovec with the National Weather Service in College Park, Maryland. Heavy rain also was forecasted for southeast New England and the New York City area, and some fell in coastal sections further down the coast, Orovec said. In North Carolina's Outer Banks, an area that's seen significant storm damage this season, ocean overwash came across Highway 12 in a motel near Buxton, the Dare County Sheriff's Office posted online yesterday. Waves were ferocious at the Hatteras Island town of Buxton, where a number of beachfront homes had fallen into the water in recent weeks. The waves are crashing really hard into the houses and the dunes, and it's all eroding, said Robert Splon, who was watching on the beach. Flooding was widespread down the coast in Georgetown County, South Carolina, where several motorists had to be rescued when rising waters inundated their cars. Emergency Services Director Brandon Ellis told the Post and Courier on Sunday. The Weather Service said parts of the county had received up to 7 inches of rain, and further down in Charleston, South Carolina, many streets downtown were closed because of the flooding. And turning to sports, Big 12 after dark, anybody? Arizona's 33-27 loss to number 18 BYU in double overtime on Saturday was a Pac-12 after dark-esque special, which featured wild plays and momentum swings, and it ended up being a late-night game due to the effects of Tropical Storm Priscilla that made its way through southern Arizona over the weekend. The Cats overcame a 2-touchdown deficit in the early stages of the game, even held a double-digit lead in the fourth quarter. But in the end, the Cougars prevailed to preserve their unbeaten record and winning streak over Arizona, which fell to 4-2 on the season. We just battled the first-place team in the Big 12 for 4 quarters and 2 overtimes, and we never backed down, said Arizona head coach Brent Brennan. Arizona, and he said that there are notable storylines, statistics, and quotes, among other pertinent information, from the loss to BYU. We didn't get the result we wanted, but these kids played their hearts out, and that's something you'd be excited about. The goal is to win, and I understand that. We're a better football team. We've got some work to do, but we have a lot to feel good about as well. The thing that's so hard about it is that we were unable to get it done. And next up is Arizona, that is 4-2 overall, 1-2 in the conference, versus Houston, who's 5-1 and 2-1 in the conference. 9 o'clock a.m. next Saturday at TDECU Stadium in Houston, and it's available to watch on Fox Sports 1 or listening on 1290 AM or 107.5 FM and 92.5 FM for Spanish. Michael Lev, in his column, says that it was a game that Arizona football easily could have won. It was also the type of game that last year's Cats would have lost badly. Down two scores early, Arizona rallied back against number one BYU, only to fall in double overtime, 33-27, in a draining, entertaining, weather-delayed contest on Saturday night at Arizona Stadium. The game featured wild momentum swings, controversial decisions, and a failure on Arizona's part to execute in key moments. And here's the top five takeaways from a stinging defeat that leaves the Cats at 4-2 at the halfway point of the season. Number one, net positive. The way the game unfolded left the U of A fans furious. The Cats had a 10-point lead in the fourth quarter and let it slip away. Brent Brennan made some decisions that had a lot of us scratching our heads. In the meantime, I'd argue that Saturday's game was actually a net positive. Arizona exhibited character and mettle that it rarely showed last season. And if you get it, everyone's like, yay, Brennan said. If you don't, everyone's like, what are you doing? Coming out of last season, we all wanted Brennan to be more aggressive in situations. Overall, he's been seen as maybe a little afraid to do so. Arizona has gone for it on fourth and down and 15, fourth and down on 15 times. The Cats went just 18 times all of last year. If you look at Brennan's fourth down decision in the third quarter through that lens, it's justifiable. It was the opening possession of the second half. Before Brennan made a call to go for it, I told colleagues in the press box that I would kick the field goal. It would have been a disappointing end to a 7-plus-minute drive, but it would bump Arizona's lead to 6 points and would beat the alternative if the Cats didn't make it, an empty possession and a shift in momentum. Arizona didn't make it. You could argue at 3 points, though Cats lost up in costing them the game, although the Cougars would have played things differently if they were down 13 instead of 10 in the fourth quarter. For example, they wouldn't have kicked a field goal from the U of A 6 with less than 4 minutes and 30 seconds left in regulation. That's the Arizona Star for Monday. Thank you for joining me this morning. Mark DeGroft with you. See you again on Wednesday. Till then, take care.